Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're opening the show today with the second of our two-part discussion with the Connecticut Food System Alliance and a recent report they participated in to help inform all of New England as they pursue a goal of producing and consuming 30% of New England's food throughout the region by 2030. Then we're reconnecting with AARP to focus on several communities across Connecticut that are receiving AARP Community Challenge grants this year. Five Connecticut projects were chosen from over 3,000 applicants, so stay tuned to hear and learn about each of these innovative community building initiatives that'll all be completed by this fall. And we'll close chatting with a local physical therapist about the unique issues and needs of our community of first responders, and how he and a group from Sacred Heart University's physical therapy program will be providing free treatments to first responders from all over Connecticut at an upcoming event in Fairfield at the end of the month. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder from Connecticut's Department of Consumer Protection. You know, adults who choose to grow cannabis at home need to follow all laws and regulations and use safe gardening practices. Under the law, all adults 21 and older may grow up to 3 mature and 3 immature plants in their home with a maximum of 12 plants per household. And that became effective on July 1st. Plants should be secure from children, pets, and others who should not have access to cannabis, and cannabis must be grown indoors in a secured, locked area that's not visible to the public. Resources regarding responsible cannabis use, as well as information about addiction and health risks, is available for you right now at ct.gov/cannabis. Well, folks, if you were with us last week, then you heard the front half of our conversation with Meg Horrigan. She's coordinator of the Connecticut Food System Alliance, and Martha Page, who's with the Alliance Steering Committee. And for those of you who may have missed last week's opening segment, we encourage you to go to any of our radio station websites, pull down the podcast tag, and check out the first interview or the entire program from last week, because we had some other good stuff on as well. And we're picking up the conversation now with our two resources from this organization, the Connecticut Food Systems Alliance. The report that we're talking about put forth a regional goal of producing and consuming 30% of New England's food needs in the region by 2030. It was commissioned by the New England State Food System Planners Partnership, which is a collaboration between the Alliance and five other state-level organizations, and it outlines the role New Englanders can play in making the region's food system stronger and more self-reliant. So let's start things off by checking in with both of you on the key findings of the research. Four main sections, starting with dietary patterns. Who's going to clue us in on the details we need to know about that?
Martha, I've got a strong public health background, so this particular area of research is near and dear to my heart. And then Meg will pick it up with some of the other areas. Overall, in the research, the research teams determined that producing 30% of what we consume in New England is possible, but that there is a tremendous amount of coordination and planning to get there. And it is, as with anything in the food system, it is a very, very complex topic. Anytime you're talking about what do people eat and how do they get it, it gets very complex very quickly. And one of the things that the research teams looked at is specifically around what do people in New England broadly eat now, and is there a way to think about diets to be more in alignment with recommended dietary guidelines? So they, the research group looked at two different diet patterns, something they called unchanged eating, how our diets look today, which is low in fruit and vegetables, higher in fats and sugar, versus resilient eating, which we will get into more detail in a little bit, a diet with more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, less meat, and processed sugars. And how would that resilient eating allow us to make progress toward the 30% goal? There was no intention in this research to be prescription, you know, prescriptive in what people eat, not trying to dictate what they should eat, but to just get an understanding of where we are now so that we would know what actions might be possible to be able to get to resilient eating and at the same time achieve food security for everyone as a part of that resilience.
Very good. How about in terms of food production?
Yes. So this research team was looking at how much and what kinds of food we produce now compared to how much we consume currently. And we found that there really needs to be a lot more sustainable food production on more farmland. In New England, the estimate is about 1 million acres across the region. And just to put that in context, there are today about 2 million acres of land in agriculture in New England. And compared to 1945, there were 6.8 million acres of agricultural land. So 1 million sounds like a lot, but in the course of history, really, we have been changing that needle a lot. Like, this kind of systemic level change is attainable in our lifetimes. So the food production team was working on this term called regional self-reliance, which is defined as the estimate of the region's production of particular food groups compared to our consumption of those commodities. And that number varies widely from product to product. For example, in New England, we're more than 50% self-reliant in potatoes, barley, blueberries, maple syrup, cranberries, and rye, and we produce actually well over 100% of what we consume for a lot of seafood products like clams, haddock, lobster, and mussels. But for fruits and vegetables and the things that you typically think of as like a farmer's market or farm stand fair, like broccoli and cherries, lettuce, onions, strawberries, we're actually less than 5% self-reliant. 5% of those fruits and vegetables that are consumed in New England are produced here.
It's so interesting. Then, oh, go ahead, Meg, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to add that dairy, apples, things like blackberries, sweet corn, crab, and honey are all sit in like the 20 to 50% regional self-reliance range.
Hmm. I was going to say it's so interesting that, half a century or more ago, we had six times the farmland and production, and it really kind of to an uneducated viewer on the sidelines like me, it looks like as the production and the farmland being used for that production trended downward in terms of its utilization and availability, the consumption of food started getting away from the proper balance of fruits and vegetables in the diet. Is that correlation borne out in the research?
That's an interesting question, and I'm not sure that the researchers looked at it in that way specifically. But there is clear indications that, you can get anything you need at any time of the year, and that is just not something that our grandparents experienced. Strawberries, there is nothing that tastes like a Connecticut strawberry in June. And I also would say that there's nothing that tastes like a wherever it's produced strawberry in January. In fact, it's probably the right way to say it is that it tastes like nothing.
Sure.
So I am sure I'm not sure if there's a direct correlation between that and the loss of farmland, but there is certainly a correlation between what our diets look like now and the fact that the food that the food supply lines have gone global and that you can get anything at any time.
So what about economic? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Meg.
Well, just for more about the change in the overall amount of ag lands in New England, American Farmland Trust's Farms Under Threat report is really does a lot of has a lot of great information about how that massive transition of land use has occurred. Yeah. So direct people to that resource from American Farmland Trust.
So how about economic impact as it was examined in this report?
Yeah. One of the things about looking at this from a food systems perspective is a lot of the ways that data gets collected is, you know, here's agriculture and here's everything else. It's always kind of pulled out. So the research combining information about the agricultural economy with the rest of the like food system basically is a unique feature to the research. And we were able to find that food system jobs that cover, and this covers things from farm labor and the related agricultural services, food chain and restaurant labor, processing and distribution, and things like that, that accounts for almost 1 million jobs in the region, or almost 1 in 10 of all jobs. And about half of these are in food service. And at the same time, total food and agricultural sales in New England is about $190 billion annually, and that's about 11% of all sales of anything in the region. But that total food and agricultural sales obviously is including the food that's coming in from outside of New England. In spite of this massive economic contribution, employment and sales in agriculture and fisheries are actually either flat or declining, and we definitely need to see more development in food and agriculture careers and for people to be earning better wages and getting benefits, full-time employment, and things like that, so that the food system, in addition to supporting our health and our ecosystems here, it's also really supporting people's livelihoods. We found that there's a need for more infrastructure in food distribution and aggregation, like warehouses, processing facilities, transportation, and these other critical links so that farmers have more options for selling their produce locally. The researchers found that if we achieve this 30x30 vision, this would grow agricultural sales from $2 billion, which they were in 2017, to somewhere between $4 and $5.5 billion. As well as 6,000 to 9,000 more jobs. And that range comes from the difference in the production of the resilient eating diet, which Martha mentioned, versus the unchanged eating, with the resilient eating dietary pattern having stronger economic growth.
So let me just give you a time check. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left. So let's briefly touch on market demand, because as Martha pointed out, all you need to do is take the Chilean strawberry in December and the Connecticut grown strawberry in May or June. And, there's no question which one the market is going to like better. But what do we need to know briefly about market demand?
I think that that's a great lead-in to kind of like, you know, to the question around market demand. It's where do the researchers looked at, where do people get most of their food from? And that's grocery stores and restaurants. And so increasing local and regional options in these spaces is not just important, it's critical to the achievement. You are not going to achieve the 30x30 with more people shopping at farmers markets. We have to change where most people get their food from, is in grocery stores and in restaurants. And so if you can make inroads into those spaces, then the potential really, really exists to achieve what the goal of the project. New England has some of the highest household food expenditures in the country, about $5,867 per person per year. And that number has grown by more than 50% since 1997. If we're going to reach the 30x30 goal, the average New England household would be spending about $2,900 or $1,100 per person on regional food products. And when you put it that way, that sounds very achievable. We're not suggesting that people need to go out and do extra, that within their current, if more of that is local, more of that demand can, then that it, that becomes, it, this becomes achievable.
Right. Well, we've been teasing folks about resilient eating for two segments now in the last couple minutes that we have. Let's go back to Meg to talk a little bit about resilient eating and what a resilient food system looks like.
So just really briefly, the food system is just all of the inputs, like land and materials and seeds, processes, ranging from agriculture to distribution and retail and composting, and people, so farmers, farm workers, food chain workers, everybody who's involved in the production, distribution, and consumption. And since we as eaters are part of the food system, we're all part of the food system. And thinking about grocery stores or farmers is part of that we're separate from. The working definition for resilience that we used in this research is the collective ability to prepare for, respond to, and recover from adverse conditions and disruptions. So the pandemic is a huge example, and climate change are huge examples of disruptions in these systems. We really don't consider it resilience if all of the negative effects of a disruption are dumped on vulnerable people, particularly lower income and people of color, while concentrating those benefits for a small number of more privileged people. And so we've seen this play out in the pandemic and climate change, that while major food corporations have been posting these record profits, workers at meat processing plants and other points along the food chain have been disproportionately exposed to and killed by COVID. Mm-hmm. These resilient systems, we want to see more flexibility, more adaptability, more diversity and inclusion, and even redundancy in the system versus a vulnerable system, which will tend to be rigid, highly consolidated, opaque, not able to get a lot of information about it, and exclusionary and exploitative, which is some of the main reasons that we saw those empty grocery shelves and saw that farmers were having to dump milk in the early stages of the pandemic. So because our food supply chains are designed with the goal of maximizing efficiency and profit, they are not really designed for resilience. And that designing for resilience means we need to consider other factors such as sustainability, equity, and planning for disruption.
Okay. Martha, we've saved the last word for you. In a nutshell, looking back on what you've learned from this report, what are a couple of the most important things we could take away in terms of the importance to Connecticut specifically?
We've already touched on some of it, and I think that some of it is worth reemphasizing. In Connecticut, we are 24% of the region's population. We have more than 20% of the region's food system jobs, and we have more than 25% of the region's food and agricultural sales. With that dominant position, there is a whole lot that can be done here. So if we get serious about local, sourcing local, buying local, buying regionally, the impact that Connecticut, as small as we are geographically, we are a powerhouse when it comes to impact in the food system. If we spend our dollars locally and regionally, the impact on farmers and food chain workers, our economy overall, the health of our residents is can be very, very significantly impacted. There's a lot to understand in this research. There are lots of numbers and lots of charts, and a little bit difficult to digest. But I think that a bottom line understanding that Connecticut has a huge role to play in building a resilient food system is something that we would want everybody to take home.
Very good. We appreciate you both coming on the program for these two parts, these two segments over the last couple of weeks. Folks, if you missed the first part of the conversation, you can just go to our radio station website, pull down the podcast tab, and look for the People's episode 1, segment one from July 2nd. And we also want to let you know, if you want to dig deeper into the report, you can find it at nefoodsystemplanners.org. That's nefoodsystemplanners.org. And it's under the projects and reports pull down tab. Meg Horrigan is the coordinator for the Connecticut Food Systems Alliance, and Martha Page is also with us with the CFSA. She's on the steering committee. I thank you both for all the great resources and information today, and for your hard work. And I imagine we will probably be talking to you again as some of the things you hope to inspire or initiate out of this report begin to get traction towards this goal of 2030 and the amount of local food production for local consumers that we'd like to see. Thank you both so much. Well, earlier this year, we were talking to our friends at AARP and prepping you to apply for the latest round of 2023 Community Challenge Grants, which are essentially projects, quick turnaround projects, which will be funded, with a pot of $3.6 million around the country. And this year's big news in Connecticut, because five organizations throughout the state are going to receive 2023 Community Challenge Grants. So now we're on the back end of the process. All the vetting has been done. The awards have been given. And we're going to talk about the program and celebrate this year's grantees with Anna Duragazi. She's AARP's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach. And as I told Ann before we turned on the microphone this morning, I've got a little bit of that Canadian smoke going on in my throat here. So you'll maybe hearing me clear my throat a couple of times. I apologize for that. Anna, to you too as well. Welcome to the program and thanks for joining us. And congratulations to you and your team for getting the word out to the extent where you had so many applicants into the national program that were recognized in our tiny little state of Connecticut.
Great. Thank you so much for having me back on. This is the part I love, where I get to talk with you about all of the folks who applied for the grants and won the grants. We had a huge pool of applicants this year, and it's really exciting that Connecticut towns and nonprofits were able to receive five of these grants.
So, as we talked about in the program where we were seeking to inform communities and groups in them to apply, we kind of reviewed a number of the types of projects, but there's also a criteria and a qualification that calls for these projects to come to fruition really quickly, which was something that I thought was the best part of it, because it's not one of those things where, we set off all the fireworks and yay, we got the grant. And then two or three years later, we're still sort of in the tail end of a planning process. These things happen real quickly, don't they?
They do. Yeah. So one of the things that is unique about this grant program is that they're designed to really help build momentum to improve livability for residents of these communities. So when we say, quick action project, we just announced the awards and we need these communities to have everything kind of done and wrapped up with a bow on it by November of this year. So the idea here is that we know it can take a really long time for communities to become more livable for people of all ages. But this grant program is intended to make immediate improvements and to help jumpstart some of the long-term change that we hope to see.
So I think looking back across the years to 2017, which is as far back as our information goes on the web, it started small with 88 projects across the country, and then a year later, up to 130, and then it started to grow 160, 184 by 2020. And then, it continues to grow. And I think that probably speaks to both the success of the communications out to the various communities and groups that would hope to apply, but also to the fact that the outcomes of these grants are making such a difference.
I think so. I think, you know, we're in our seventh year now with this national grant. As you've mentioned, it's just grown year over year. So this year, for example, is our largest group of grantees to date. So nationwide, we have $3.6 million being awarded to 310 organizations nationwide. You know, and here's one of the really exciting things. There were 3,600 applications this year for those 310 grants that were ultimately awarded. So this is a very competitive grant program. And, you know, across 50 states, D.C., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, it's really exciting that five of these 310 grantees are right here in the little state of Connecticut.
Now, there are also three different kind of categories, if you will, that these grants are awarded in, right?
Right. And that was something that was new for this year. So, you know, the first 6 years of the grant program, we focused on what we call, you know, our flagship grants. And these grants are focused on improving public spaces, transportation, housing, diversity, equity, and inclusion, digital connections, community resilience, and community health and economic empowerment. Mm-hmm. So that's still a really broad category of what kind of projects fall within that flagship grant category. But this year we did something new, which was to expand out into two new areas. One of them is something that we called our capacity building micro grants. And these were a really exciting opportunity for folks, you know, communities and nonprofits that wanted to focus specifically on improving walkability in community gardens. So folks who applied for this grant, they're smaller grant amounts. I think $2,500 was the maximum grant for these. But in addition to the financial grant, folks who won these grants are also going to have access to some national experts to give them a little bit of technical assistance as they go about, you know, with these walkability and community garden projects.
And then the demonstration grants really bring in some heavy hitters, right?
Yeah. So these demonstration grants are bigger projects that are intended to fund projects that are going to move communities toward transportation systems change or through housing choice design competitions. So the Transportation Systems Change grant is something totally new. AARP partnered with Toyota Motor North America for that. So these were, you know, up to $50,000 for projects that are going to help kickstart more accessible transportation systems throughout the U.S.
And I see that some of these grants, you know, went to communities in Arizona, California, Georgia, nothing here yet in Connecticut for these, but a very interesting group of grantees here and how they want to apply that money for this brand new category of demonstration grants. So turning our attention back home to Connecticut here, and before we take a quick break, let's turn our focus back onto our local grantees here. And we're going to start off with these up in Litchfield County in Goshen with the Goshen Land Trust.
Yeah, so Goshen Land Trust applied for a grant and received a grant this year for a project that's going to install benches and informational signage along a new accessible loop trail. The idea here is that by making these outdoor spaces at Goshen Land Trust more accessible, You're going to be able to have more folks of all ages and abilities outside having a great experience in nature. I feel like we've seen a lot more of these sorts of projects in the last couple of years, especially, post-pandemic, there was a really big emphasis on creating really great outdoor spaces for folks. And I think we've seen that trend reflected in the grantees that received awards this year, as well as folks who have received some of our state level grants. Just a lot of interest in getting folks outside and making the outdoors more accessible.
Perfect for the fall projected completion date, especially up in Litchfield, where folks want to get out and look at some of the the Berkshire neighborhood fall foliage and sites up there. That's great. Anna Doragazi is with us. She is the AARP Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach here in Connecticut. But we're talking about the nationwide community grants program. And we are going to take a quick break and come back and tell you about all of the rest of the Connecticut communities that have achieved success in applying for and receiving these community challenge grants right here in our state. We'll be back. Stay with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Arg, shiver me timbers. Pirates have been around for as long as people have sailed the world seas. And now scallywags of all ages can step into a world of pirates on Saturday, July 22nd and Sunday, July 23rd when purchasing a ferry ride ticket to Sheffield Island for the Pirates Weekend hosted by the Norwalk Seaport Association. This is the weekend to experience the freedom of a pirate's life and to learn about their lore and history. Get the ferry schedule, reserve tickets, and get all the details you need by going to seaport.org. We are back. Thanks for sticking with us. If you're in New Haven, Willimantic, or in Windsor Locks, congratulations to you for being among the winners of these National Challenge Grants. AARP Connecticut just clued us in a few days ago that five organizations throughout the state are going to be receiving a 2023 Community Challenge Grants as part of the largest group of grantees to date. 310 organizations nationwide are going to be drawing from this $3.6 million allocation to help communities become more livable by improving public places, transportation, housing, digital connections, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and more, with an emphasis on the needs of adults age 50 and older. So we just, before the break, we're talking with Anna about the Goshen Land Trust and their wish to put benches and informational signage along a new accessible loop trail. So now we're going to dial it back down south here from the kind of the sleepy bucolic town of Goshen to the city of New Haven. Anna, tell us what the city of New Haven's Department of Elderly Services is going to do with their challenge grant funds.
Yeah, so the city of New Haven, their Department of Elderly Services applied for and won one of these grants, and they are going to help create some more welcoming and accessible outdoor spaces by installing benches at three senior centers and nearby parks. So what we liked, it's AARP staff and volunteers here in Connecticut that help, with the initial screening and scoring of these applications. And this application jumped out to us because it was really explicitly directed at older adults residing in New Haven and coming up with ways to get them out of their residence and outside of the senior center to really connect with some of the parks and public spaces that are in that community. So we thought that particular grant did a really nice job of targeting older adults in the New Haven community and is going to make it a lot nicer for folks to get outside and enjoy some of the amenities in New Haven parks.
So for Connecticut to get 5 awards out of 3,100 plus applicants is pretty amazing in and of itself. But for the city of Willimantic to actually get 2 of those 5 has really got to be a first of its kind thing. Let's hear what's going on way out east in Willimantic.
Yeah, well, so this is exciting. One of the winners of this National Community Challenge grant this year was the Garden Club of Willimantic, with the Friends of the Garden on the Bridge. These folks also won one of our state-level grants, I believe last year, maybe the year before that. But they're doing a lot of work to transform the Garden on the Bridge area mm-hmm. in Willimantic. So the project that they just won some funding for is going to transform a neglected park into a more welcoming and functional recreation space. So they're envisioning fixing up this area with some seating and tables to encourage outdoor recreation and to really help the community socialize and have some more intergenerational interactions. So they're just doing a lot of work in this area, trying to connect some of the existing spaces and infrastructure to really connect it to nice public spaces, to public gardens, to some of the businesses downtown. That's something, you know, that we really, again, enjoyed about this application is that it had a big vision for the whole community. You know, it wasn't just, hey, we're going to make one spot look nice. They were really thoughtful in their application about, you know, if we create a nice space, you know, in this spot in Willimantic, what is that going to mean for the neighborhood businesses? What's that going to mean for, you know, community members who are just passing by?
So we
thought that was a great project.
And fulfilling one of the key qualifying points. So Willimantic is also going to be helping to create more locally grown food and distributing it to those who need it most, particularly older adults.
Yeah. So the town of Windham, Human Services Department also received a grant. And with these grant funds, they're going to create a community gardening program to help older adults who want to grow food locally. So this grant is really exciting. It's one of the brand new capacity building micro grants that I had mentioned earlier, where it's just a small amount of grant funding, but they're also, as part of the funding, they're going to receive some support from AARP, as well as a fantastic organization called 880 Cities. And that is going to help them succeed in, you know, designing this new green space at a senior center and then providing the tools and some weekly group sessions with a master gardener to really help community members take full advantage of this new community garden.
And for those of us who do air travel and go in and out of Bradley Airport, that may be our sole experience in Windsor Locks. However, AARP has recognized that community for a project out of this year's grant round as well. So maybe when you're going to or coming back from Windsor Locks to the airport, maybe you'll venture downtown and see the benefits of this year's AARP grant.
Sure. So, you know, a lot like, the Garden Club of Windham's project in Willimantic, where they're taking sort of a neglected outdoor space and making it more functional and welcoming for the community, the town of Windsor Locks is going to transform an underutilized alley space into a downtown community gardening and socializing space. So the space is there, not looking so great just yet, but they have a really wonderful vision to use their grant funding to create garden beds and outdoor seating. So this is going to be a really great opportunity to enhance and improve sort of a neglected piece of downtown space and hopefully, you know, really open that up for the community and make it a spot that where people want to stop and enjoy instead of just, you know, rushing past or avoiding it altogether.
So I imagine at this point, people who are community-minded, who are listening to the broadcast or the podcast are saying, boy, let's see if we can make it 6 or 7 next year for Connecticut and make my town one of them. When does the whole process for the next round of these AARP awards and community challenge grants begin?
So the next cycle for our national grant, they typically kick off in January or February. You know, one way to make sure that you stay informed about this national community challenge grant, or to receive information about a smaller scale statewide community challenge grant that we manage here out of our state office, is to get on our grant list. So we keep a list of folks, and anytime we have an opportunity for grant funding related to livable communities, we reach out to this list. So if you are hearing this and this sounds exciting, if you have an idea that you think you know, fits the bill and could be eligible for funding, feel free to reach out to us at ct@aarp.org. So again, ct@aarp.org, and say, you know, hey, we heard about you and this grant program, and we're really interested in staying informed for future opportunities.
It's great that these grants will not only benefit individuals, although they're targeted at individuals who are of AARP membership age, as is the case with many AARP initiatives. This is something that will benefit everyone in the community, and in particular, in some cases, community members who may need the resources most. Thank you, Anna Doragazi, AARP's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach, and congratulations to the Goshen Land Trust, the City of New Haven Department of Elderly Services, the Garden Club of Wyndham, the Town of Wyndham's Human Services, and the Town of Windsor Locks. Five of the 310 AARP Community Challenge grants across the country this year. And we'll be back to tell you about the application process when it opens up in the wintertime. Thank you, Anna, for being with us and to brief us on these projects. Well, we have many opportunities to talk about and provide support for those who answer the call for help. I'm talking about first responders, EMTs, paramedics, firefighters, police officers, dive rescue people, a wide variety of responders are there for us. And sometimes, due to their unique line of work, they may suffer some injuries or ongoing issues. And that's where Anthony Amante and Visionary Physical Therapy come in. Coming up later on in July, Visionary Physical Therapy and the students at the physical therapy program at Sacred Heart University are going to be giving back to those responders with free 30-minute physical therapy sessions. And we are here with Anthony Amante to talk more about that and to make sure that everybody within the sound of our voice who is or knows a first responder shares this information with them, because we'd certainly like to fill every session possible with every student possible who is going to be involved in this. Anthony, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John. I really appreciate it.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. You're a physical therapist. When did Visionary Physical Therapy come into being?
Yep. So I am a physical therapist with my alumni being Sacred Heart University. I graduated their DPT program in 2021, and I opened up Visionary in January of this year. So I'm, you know, pretty new to running my own business, but here we are.
So tell us a little bit about what you know, either from your training or anecdotally or through patients you may already have who are first responders. A lot of times various industries are associated with certain unique issues that may help or may compromise that individual's ability to do their work. Certainly having some knowledge of emergency medical response and fire service and law enforcement, it's easy to see where in any given moment something could go wrong and someone could get injured. And the difference between getting back in the seat and back to helping people expeditiously all comes down to the expertise of people like you.
Yeah, I think that was very well said. I would say just like a blanket overarching theme of first responders is they're so focused on taking care of other people that sometimes, you know, they might neglect or not even have the time to take care of themselves. So, yeah, some current patients that I do see, police officers, firefighters, et cetera, come in with pretty generic stuff, some shoulder pain, neck and back pain, stuff that needs just be related to day-to-day operations, or maybe there is an incident that happened on the job that really caused a severe injury, and then it's our job as physical therapists, anybody else in the healthcare world to help get these people back to where they need to be. And being able to do that is super rewarding and is one of the reasons why I got into this healthcare field in the first place.
Well, you know, and I know both that most of the individuals that come to these fields of public service are in love with the job. They, you know, they're not in it for the money. They're in it to help other people. And it's so disheartening to hear how sometimes injuries that may have been able to be mitigated soon after they occur, as you pointed out, are neglected and end up cutting the careers of these people short because they develop into lifelong debilitating situations, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, you can take an athlete for an example. A high-level athlete might get injured playing their sport, and we're super focused on returning them back to the field of play, et cetera. I think it's super important for anybody in any job, but especially first responders. We got to get you back to play, too, because if we don't, and we're putting other people at risk who might need their assistance in their day-to-day job. And they do so much for us. So I think it's super important to just try to give back to them a little bit. Mm. So again, that's why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah, the other thing that's kind of unique about Connecticut is this patchwork of municipal services as well as volunteer services. So you may encounter some patients who are constantly on the go. They work in very busy situations or very busy municipalities or departments, and they're constantly on calls, while others may be from more suburban or rural communities where, you know, they might have another full-time job, and their response to their work as volunteers may happen at night or on the weekends or very occasionally. I would imagine it is those individuals who might be surprised to learn that due to the fact that they're often not really constantly busy and taking care of themselves as responders, but only sort of like kind of weekend warriors, so to speak, that sometimes their injuries can be pretty bad, right?
Absolutely. You know, just being in tune with your body is tough to do when you're in one of these positions and you're working so much. And again, in these positions, these guys and gals, you know, they're always putting in overtime work as well. So again, taking that time to just kind of reflect on yourself and say, oh, you know what? My knee has really been bothering me for months on end. Let's go get it checked out. Let's get some work on it, and let's get it feeling better so we can feel good during our day-to-day operations, for sure.
So what are a couple of the most common injuries that you're seeing among responders or that you know of to be occurring with folks who are in emergency services?
I would say on-the-job injuries, like more traumatic injuries, we tend to see a lot of knees and shoulders. And then when you're having just day-to-day aches and pains, it tends to be a little bit more generated in the spine, so some cervical spine or neck problems, whether it's tightness or pain going down the arm. Same thing with the low back as well. Just years and years of that style work just wears down on the body and the spine, and then the patients get a little bit of pain. And again, that's where we step in to help.
So tell us a little bit about these students who are now where you once were and about this upcoming event at the end of the month.
Absolutely. So I have six students working with me, all from the Sacred Heart University physical therapy program. Again, it's my alma mater. They helped to shape me into the PT that I am today. And that's what the students are doing right now. So They're getting ready to head into their clinical field work, which is their last year of the PT program. So this is one of their kind of capstone projects to kind of end up their academic work. So on Sunday, July 30th from 8 a.m. to 12, we're going to be doing some treatment, some evaluations. We have saunas, a cold plunge, massage chairs, all the good stuff to get people feeling really good. And the students have been working really hard at it, and it's super rewarding to be in this position to do this now.
So where do they go to learn more or sign up? And where is Visionary Physical Therapy's offices located?
Yep. So I am located in the Sportsplex in Fairfield at 85 Mill Plain Road. We are suite P and Q. There's two entrances. To find out a little bit more about this and to sign up, we do have a sign-up link on my Instagram, which is at Visionary Physical Therapy. And then to make it even easier for people, I also have a phone number dedicated to this, which is my business line, where you can text the number or call the number to set up a link appointment. And that number is 475-239-4749. So a couple different options to get you on schedule for this free assessment and treatment.
So the best place to do, to go for those who may not have been able to make note of the number is to go to Visionary Physical Therapy's Instagram page and look for the link to sign up. And you are welcoming responders from anywhere across Connecticut to take part in this free physical therapy initiative for first responders. Anthony Amante is a physical therapist, a Sacred Heart University graduate, and the founder of Visionary Physical Therapy. And he will be joined by a number of physical therapy students from Sacred Heart University for this event. Once again, Visionary Physical Therapy Instagram, if you'd like to come out. And if you know a first responder, please be sure to tell them about it. Anthony, thank you so much for your time this morning, and best of luck with the event, and congratulations for making this happen.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.